history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty incredible stories out there that need to be told, that need to be heard, and we're not going to hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen. So each week we seek to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these members of our greatest generation. The gentleman we're going to meet today just returned from an honor flight to Washington, D.C. We're going to talk about that before we're done, but we're going to go way back to Southern California in the 1930s with 92-year-old Larry Cosgrove of Signal Hill, California. That's right in and around Long Beach in SoCal. And Larry, you grew up around Los Angeles, the San Fernando Valley, at a time where I'm sure it was much different from today. I think most of us, especially who don't live in L.A., think of the San Fernando Valley, and the first thing we think of is traffic. That probably wasn't the case in the 1930s, right?
No. We lived on a dirt street that had two ruts. If you went over 15 miles an hour, you'd be bounced out of the car.
And what kind of car would you be riding in back then?
Model A.
Of course.
Well, we had also had a 30 Chevy, but it had a pickup bed in the back. They took the rumble seat out. That was used for the truck farming.
And you had an older brother, and you and he were tasked with keeping up the chicken ranch there?
We did a lot of egg gathering. We had to go out in the morning and make sure the water containers were full of water. We did get, even though it was Southern California, there were days that it went below freezing and the water containers would freeze over, and they were round about 18 or 20 inches wide. We had to break the ice out of that so the chickens could get, or turkeys, we also had turkeys, and they could get to the water. So that was our duties there. But we worked in the fields too. My uncle did truck farming, which is raising vegetables, and just for people that don't know what truck farming is.
Sure.
So we worked in the fields too, but we had a lot of fun too. Didn't have to wear shoes to school. We walked to school until we got old enough to get bicycles and ride them.
You're still in Southern California, and Hollywood was up and running, and there were plenty of movie stars running around. Is that something that you were exposed to at a young age?
There were quite a few lived in the San Fernando Valley. As in fact, one of my first jobs was delivering the Hollywood Citizen News, and one of my customers was Noah Beery Jr. That was about the closest I got to any movie actors. And, of course, at that time, he wasn't really a star, but he did get parts in Western movies. And Buck Jones lived near us, but he wasn't a customer.
I know you have a sharp memory, but do you remember, as a boy, what dreams or hopes or ambitions you had about, hey, when I grow up, here are the things that Larry's going to go do?
Well, I fortunately had a fourth-grade teacher who believed that the world turned around and because of mathematics. And if you learn mathematics, you learn logic, and therefore you'll be better shaped to learn anything. And so my aspiration, I had probably the richest relative in our family was an engineer who lived in Texas, worked for Texaco. So my aspirations were to learn as much math as I could so I could go and be an engineer when I grew up, go to college and get a degree and do something, build bridges, whatever.
And how did you and your big brother get along?
Well, he was a big brother.
So he toughened you up is what you're saying.
Well, not so much. It was, well, a little bit, yes. But we would be out on a day when we didn't have school or didn't have jobs to do. And he would ask my mother, well, if he could go and visit some of the other kids. Because we all lived maybe a mile or a mile and a half apart because it was pretty much big spreads out there. She would say, well, okay, but take your little brother. That made him miserable, so he wanted to make sure I was miserable. So, but he wasn't mean as far as hurting me in any way, but he wasn't always happy that I was along on his adventures.
You know, I've talked to a lot of folks who moved to the Los Angeles area during the Great Depression because things where they came from had gone south. But being in Southern California during those years, when the economy turned sour, when jobs were hard to come by, when so many families were hurting, did you get a sense for that? Did you understand that things were changing?
Well, I was born in Los Angeles, and my father was a carpenter. My brother was already, he was a year and a half older. At that time, my father was an adamant union man, and there was a big effort in Los Angeles to break the union. In fact, there were a number of big development companies that were hiring non-union. And he had a brother-in-law who lived in Portland, Oregon, who said, "Hey, everything runs by the unions up here. Not a wheel turns if the union doesn't approve." So my father took my mother and his two boys, and we moved to Portland, Oregon. And when I was 5 years old, unfortunately, he was killed in a construction accident. I'm not sure exactly what happened, but in any case, he was killed. And my mother had two sisters and a brother that owned the chicken ranch in Van Nuys. And they told her, "You can't take care of the boys by yourself." So we moved back from Portland down to Los Angeles to the ranch. My uncle had worked for some company, and he got laid off. And the one aunt also worked for some construction company. I think it was one of the construction companies that was primary in getting rid of the unions. She got laid off because they just stopped working. No building was being done. And then the other aunt worked for See's Candy, and she had a supervisor job there, and so she kept working, but in about the mid-30s, she got cancer, and so she had to quit work. So everybody worked. We always had some kind of a job. My brother and I, just to make a few dimes, we'd gather fruit and take it around the neighbors that lived over into the more populated part of Van Nuys that didn't have big fields around them, that didn't grow stuff. We'd sell them, go pull weeds, mow lawns. Then I got delivering newspapers. That was kind of a steady job. So I had every day after school, I had to go get the newspapers. I got the newspaper job, I was 14. Mm-hmm. I think you had to be 14 then. I did that for a while, and then I got a better job with the Evening Herald and Examiner. It was a Hearst newspaper. That was just a little bigger route, and it paid a little bit more. But, you know, maybe $20 a month if you worked hard.
And I'm sure some people are listening to this, and you're describing it like it's no big deal. This is your life. You went through it. You made the best of it. You overcame it. Some people are listening to that and say, "Man, guy went through a lot. His father died when he was 5 years old and had to move back and live with all these other relatives he probably didn't know that well, and everyone's in this together." When you look back on that time now, how do you evaluate it or see maybe what came of it in your life?
Well, when my father died, I was too young to really understand. I knew something bad had happened. It was Irish, had a wake at the house and with the casket in the living room. And I can remember my mother telling my brother and I, there was a kneeler by the casket, come up, and this is the last time you're going to see your father. Well, I know it was a sad thing. I know everybody's feeling poorly, and it was something bad, but I was just too young to really realize that. But you have to understand one thing. Pictures I have from Portland, Oregon, we were all bundled up, big mufflers and and coats and boot galoshes. How do you go out and play in that? And we come back to San Fernando Valley, and we're out there running around with no shoes and no shirts on. And it was heaven to a young boy that where you come from that atmosphere to what we had, pretty much total freedom.
So you told us you have these aspirations of being an engineer. You're sticking to mathematics. You're going through high school. And while you were in high school is when the world changed and so many lives were changed. Did you have any inkling that war might be coming, that there was a possibility of America being attacked or being drawn into what was already happening in other parts of the world?
Well, we'd hear the adults talking about it, the worry. My uncle was a Marine in World War I, and he didn't want to see us get in the war. He was adamant about going back and bailing out Europe again. So we talked about it, but we really weren't worried. And I can just remember on December 7th, after church, a couple of buddies of mine, I had a Model A Ford then, and we went out driving around and having fun, and we pooled our money so we could go buy a couple of gallons of gas at this little mom-and-pop store with a gas pump. And when we pulled up there, the woman that ran the place came out, and she says, "Well, what do you boys think of the war?" And we thought they were talking about China or Europe, and we said, "Well, hope we don't get in it." And she says, "Oh, we're in it." And I guess there was then that feeling of, well, we will be involved in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I've talked to a lot of folks who were in Southern California at that time, and they say the fear was then, well, the Japanese are coming right here to California. And there were blackouts at night, or they had, you know, air raid wardens that are just waiting to sound the alarm if they spot airplanes. How did your everyday life change in the wake of that news?
Well, I don't think we were really terrified that the Japanese would come in. We were going through that you had to put tape over your headlights so it would just be a little slit. You had to turn all the outside lights off. That was the glare. You know, that's what they were concerned about. Not so much that there'd be planes coming in, but if there's ships at sea, the glare would outline all the buildings and make it easier on their targets. But I think we all had an anticipation, well, we're going to be involved. I know some of my buddies, as soon as they were 17, wanted to go enlist. They had to get their parents' permission, and they could get in the Navy or the Marines. A gentleman from the military came to the school, and particularly to the students in the mathematics classes or the science classes, to take a test so you'd get into this special Army program, the ASTP, Army Specialized Training Program, and we'll teach you how to be engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took the test and passed it and then joined the enlisted Reserve Corps.
And by that time, your brother was already in the Navy? And he tried to go in right after Pearl Harbor?
He wanted to go right in.
When he said, "I want to be a Marine," what did your uncle say?
No way. He told my mother that if she signed the approval paper, he'd never speak to her again. I can remember that. It was in the living room. And he says, "Grace, if you sign that paper, I'll never speak to you again." And so she says, "I'm not going to sign the paper." So by the time he did then enlist, and he would have been drafted, he joined the Navy.
Well, and you could have waited to be drafted.
Yes. But it wouldn't have taken much longer. They deferred it until I finished school, because I graduated in June. Then in July, I got my notice and ended up down at Fort MacArthur in the induction center.
One more thing about, you know, December of 41, you hear this shocking news. Your everyday life does change a little bit as far as what you guys have to do and things you never thought of before. Had you known any Japanese Americans in the area? Did you have anyone at school or anything that was Japanese American?
Yes, I had a very close buddy, Jimmy Fujiki. He lived with his father and mother they had a truck farm too. My uncle and Jimmy's father helped each other out when they were harvesting. They'd support each other. And he was just a good friend. And there in February or March of 42, Jimmy was there one day and the next day he was gone. And we all then was told what happened. We knew what edict that Roosevelt had issued.
Yeah. Executive Order 9066.
So,
did that make sense to you? Was that hard to understand? Hey, this is my friend. We've been working together. We're all in this together. And
well, it's hard to understand, but it was also, I guess it would be the group consciousness of, hey, we've been attacked by Japanese and they're all around us. And is there a danger?
Just curious, did you ever find out what happened to your friend?
Never.
He never found out the eventual outcome, but he remembers the family selling all their belongings before being sent to an internment camp. If you're a regular Hometown Heroes listener, you've heard a lot about the Japanese-American experience during World War II. But if you'd like to really get a feel for it, I encourage you to catch the traveling exhibit, Courage and Compassion, produced by the Go for Broke National Education Center. I happened to be there in Honolulu last week for the opening of the exhibit there, and a superb speech from Admiral Harry Harris, commander of all our forces in the Pacific, who said he stands on the shoulders of the Nisei warriors of the past. If you're listening in Salem, Oregon today, maybe you saw the exhibit there before it headed to Hawaii. Up next are Monterey and Kingsburg in California. I have a link with all that information for you at hometownheroesradio.com. We're going to get back into Larry Cosgrove's story when we come back. What he did in Europe in the 467th Ordnance Evacuation Company. And you'll get a taste of one of the things that keeps him active at age 92. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
I don't pay no union dues.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 92-year-old Larry Cosgrove of Signal Hill, California. He signed up for the Army Specialized Training Program during World War II, providing the opportunity to get a college education in the military. So what was your expectation, Larry?
Well, we knew we were headed for Fort Benning, Georgia and the infantry school, but that was for basic training.
So you're supposed to do that and then go to a college campus for classes. How'd you feel about what they did to you?
It was exactly the same as the paratroopers were there, but they did push-ups when we had to, and they ran when we had to hike. But it was a basic infantry program. I have a grandson that's in the Air Force, and he went through basic. We went back to see him graduate, and they showed us films of his training, and it looked about the same. Doing the same kind of things that we did with the rifle training and the marching and the big packs and all that.
Was it a challenge for you or a piece of cake?
Oh, no, it was a challenge. They put us through some pretty strenuous efforts. We've been working, you know, always on the farm and riding our bicycles and walking, so physically I was up to it, but it was a challenge. And then just going from a relaxed issue at home, if I didn't make my bed, my mother wouldn't get too excited. But the sergeant would.
His language was probably a little different from your mother's, too.
Yes, quite a bit. And so that, you know, for all of us, we're all, I think everybody in that unit was probably 18. You know, we were still kids. Now we've got to learn to be a man. So it was rough. They didn't coddle us. They were demanding. And I remember the drill sergeant we had that right as we were getting ready to finish the 3 months, he says, "I know all of you hate me," he says, "but you may realize someday that some of the things I taught you might have saved your life." And that's probably true.
I bet it was a relief to be done with that and get to a college campus to study.
Then we shipped off to the college campus, and of course the discipline was much relaxed.
And you figured, I'll be here for a couple of years studying, just like a college kid.
That's kind of what we were looking forward to. That's why we adopted our theme song was, "Take down your service flag, mother, your son's in the ASTP.
Little did you know. So tell us what happened to change all that.
Well, in 3 months, they canceled the program. They figured that it would take too long to get us to be performing engineers, and they needed manpower elsewhere. And
they were about to launch the invasion of Europe.
Well,
it
was still a ways off, but we were then shipped down to Camp Campbell. It's a fort now, but then it was a camp. And most of the fellows went into the 14th Armored Infantry. And for some reason, I was put into a ordnance company. Did a bit of training and then overseas to England.
And some people may have an idea of what that means, but maybe you can give us a better picture. I know you can. What that unit existed for, the 467th Ordnance Evacuation Company.
Well, our main purpose was to find tanks on the battlefield that had been disabled but were not totally destroyed, and where the crews were still alive. And then we would bring a new tank up to them, to the front. Then we would pick up the old one, put it on our trailer, and take it back to the rear echelon to some maintenance unit who would repair it and put it back into service. And that was our basic assignment. Go out and find the tanks. We had recon crews, and then we had teams that took the tank transports and took a tank up to the front and then were scheduled to bring back the tanks. But Patton was moving so fast that they gave that up, and they said, forget about the damaged tanks, just leave them. Turn around, go back and get another tank and bring it up. So that was pretty much what we did, what the company did. Now, I was a driver on one of the transports for a while, but I had other, for a while, driving a 10-ton wrecker. When these things needed repairs, you had to have a pretty big unit for that. Drove a lot of Jeeps, a lot of 2.5-ton trucks, had a 3/4-ton Dodge weapons carrier for a while. We were trained in all of the motor vehicles.
And this is an element of the war in Europe that probably a lot of people have never even considered, that there would be someone with the job that you had. And I don't want to presume anything, but when you think back to that time at Camp Campbell, where just about everybody is funneled into this 14th Armored Infantry, and you go elsewhere to this ordnance company, would you say that was, in theory, a safer job than you would have had if you gone with everybody else?
Much, much so. We were in harm's way sometime, but not, you know, infantry, you're always in harm's way. And so we had areas and times that we were in danger, but for the most part, it was just a lot of hard work and a lot of very boring driving on those French and Belgian and Holland roads where they were narrow, and we had big units. And
big, slow units.
So yes. Yeah, they didn't go very – well, you couldn't. They didn't have the highways to even do it.
Sure.
If you had a freeway system.
Well, I'm sure you saw a lot of things, and I'm interested in all those things you saw. But just on this topic of that fateful turn of not going with that infantry unit, but going with this ordnance company instead. I've talked to a lot of guys that have had a moment like that where, you know, their buddies went here, they stayed there, and it wouldn't be till after the war they realized, well, what happened to the guys who went over there? But I bet for you, because of your job, you're probably getting a taste of at least the kinds of things that those guys are going through because you're delivering these tanks to where they are.
Yeah.
So that was probably with you the whole war, the perspective of, I could be doing what those guys are doing.
Yes.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, I'm not sure there was a feel. There were times when I'd read about the things that were going on. We did get some news there, and just saying, I trained for that, but thank God I'm not doing it right now.
Mm.
But later I was called, because I had the infantry training, they were needing more bodies at the front, so they pulled us out, gave us a brief retraining, but before that ended, the Germans surrendered, so I didn't actually serve as an infantry rifleman.
And I don't think you're complaining about that.
Not a bit.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can give us a sense of some of the things you saw, because you were over there for quite a long time. You got to England in, what, spring of 44?
Probably May of 44. Yeah, that would be spring.
You went across, and you were there till the Germans surrendered in May of 45.
Yes.
Right? But you must have seen a few things through that stretch.
While we were in England, we were just marshaling vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
For everybody that was getting ready for the invasion and even after the invasion. We'd load into a 2.5-ton truck, maybe 20 guys, and drive to one of the ports. And then we'd take whatever vehicles were there. I mean, this was all planned. We did what we were told. Okay, get into all those Jeeps, and you're driving them back to the depot. And the company had a maintenance depot to prepare them all. They painted the unit designations on the bumpers and whatever had to be done, make sure they're all working, and then the companies were getting ready to go into France would come get their vehicles and take them. And so most of that time I was on the road, and we had a convoy commander, and you just got in your line and followed the truck ahead of you. Then we were packed up and headed off for France.
In your time in England, did you witness or get a feel for some of the damage that had been inflicted on England?
We didn't get to any of the cities that took a lot of damage, but mm-hmm. we did see some, and we talked to people that were in some of the areas, one where the company was billeted in a building and a buzz bomb hit it, one of the V1s,
mm-hmm.
you know, one of those that didn't have a direction. They just flew until they ran out of fuel, and then they crashed,
mm-hmm.
and the Germans were hoping they'd hit something important, but they were really more for demoralizing.
Yeah.
Scaring people.
Well, I'd be scared if I don't know when something's going to fall out of the sky and blow me up.
And you'd hear them pop, pop, you know, but we didn't have any come near us. But we were really out in the country, and there were no military targets there. We were in a woods that was camouflaged. I mean, the trees covered a lot. We had a lot of vehicles in there, but they were At least they told us they were pretty much invisible from the sky. We did have a number of accidents. I had a fella go to sleep at the wheel ahead of me. We were on the now in American left-wheel drive cars on English roads on the left, driving on the left side. And every once in a while, somebody would forget or just be startled by something and, you know, try to get back where they thought they should be mentally from learning to drive here.
Sure.
And so one time a guy just went to sleep, and he was just in a Jeep. We were taking Jeeps that time, and he was ahead of me. Suddenly he just swerved, went all across the other side and off into a tree, and no seat belts. There's a windshield wiper unit up, and he just jammed his face in it. His whole eye was, we got all parked and jumped out and ran over there. The sergeant that was in charge of the convoy, he says, well, we can't do anything for him. Somebody will get him help, so get back in your vehicle and get going. You know, So we all got back, and we never saw him again. He never came. I don't know whether he lived or died or what. Then we had one time we came back from our trip, and there was one rig that went out at the same time, but we all worked independently. We didn't go in convoys in France. We started suddenly realizing, hey, you know, where's Charlie? Then later found out that these things had a big gas tank on them because we had to go a long distance and they used a lot of gas and they didn't want to have to provision gas. So they put a big gas tank on up above the fifth wheel. And nobody knows whether they got hit by a German unit that when they got up close to the front or whether an accident happened or the tank split. But when they found them, the tank had split and the whole rig had burned and all three bodies were just charred. And we had our first sergeant and our motor sergeant and our mess sergeant, right after we got into France, had decided they wanted to see what the front was like. And so they took a Jeep and they went someplace and they got hit. Might have hit a road mine. Nobody knew, but because they wouldn't tell the rank what happened.
But all three of them were killed.
Yeah.
That was right after you got to France.
That was early in our arrival at France.
But what does that do to you when you're over there, 19 years old, and guys that are doing the same thing that you're going to be doing just got killed?
Yeah. Well, it's on your mind. It's not something you just dismiss and don't worry about. But we're riding down the highway. If you're driving one of those big rigs, you've got to keep all your concentration on driving. And you've got to, either the sergeant or the alternate driver would be in the passenger on the opposite side, watching that side of the road. So it was, their minds were pretty well kept on what we were doing. And usually at night, we'd park someplace and try to stay warm. So we didn't really dwell on it. We knew that's a possibility. We knew when we got on that boat in New York, we'd already read of how many of the ships had been sunk by the wolf pack.
Sure, those U-boats in the Atlantic.
And we were in a pretty big convoy. And we had a lot of, they'd turn all the time. So you'd be up on deck during the day and you'd see these ships. There's a destroyer and here's a destroyer. And every once in a while you'd hear those whoop, 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 whoop. When they'd hit their sirens, they had some kind of a warning of something. And wow, and you see the destroyer go off in a different direction. But we made it over without any problems. There was no ships in our convoy were damaged, to my knowledge. So, it's in your mind. I just never really had a great worry. I knew there was a possibility, but it wasn't like being in the front lines or where the artillery shells were coming in or where a sniper might be up there in a tree someplace or anything. We didn't have that kind of an atmosphere. But we worried more about, would it be out in the boonies and the truck break down? You know, then what would we do? We didn't have radios. We didn't have cell phones or anything like that.
Yeah.
We'd have to find some way to get to some village where they could connect with some army communication unit and let people know what we needed. I don't want to say I was ever really worried about it. We all knew we were exposed because they were still getting reports of a truck going down some side road and hitting a mine.
Sure.
They tried to clear them all as best they... They've still got mines over there that they haven't found.
Exactly.
Because the Germans, as they retreated, they ceded the ground.
So you have the possibility of mines. I'm sure there were some times that you were in areas where enemy artillery fire was at least a possibility. German planes could be in the area. And if they see a big, slow truck with a tank on the bed? I mean, that's an easy target, right?
Am
I on track here? Are those some potential hazards you faced?
Those were certainly hazards. And the original plan, our unit had a 50 caliber machine gun on the cab. So one of us was designated as the driver and the other as the gunner, and we were interchangeable, and we had the buck sergeant was our commander. But right after we got over there, they took the 50s away and said, you don't need them. We're not forecasting any Luftwaffe resistance here. And there wasn't really, because they were using all the planes to try to stop the bombers.
Well, you just handed me a picture of a truck.
That's an M25 tank transport.
So you were driving this big monster very slowly, apparently on some snowy roads, because I'm looking at the backdrop. There's a lot of snow.
At that time, the picture was taken, because northern France and Belgium and Holland, that was through the cold winter, and there was snow.
And how did you guys deal with that snow and what, it was famously the worst winter they'd have in decades?
We just did the best we could. While we're in a truck like this, we didn't have a heater system, but that engine put off so much heat, it was warm inside the cab. But at night, when the engine's off, we had sleeping bags and a couple extra blankets.
Inside the truck?
Then we slept in the truck.
Yeah.
And we'd wake up in the morning and look out for smoke coming out of a chimney, because that was a bakery. In those little French towns and Belgian towns, the baker was always the first one up. And we'd go and trade a few packets of Nescafe for a big loaf of warm French bread. And we'd get from the mess hall, we'd get a big number can of marmalade or strawberry jam, and instead of using the rations we got for breakfast, which weren't something to write home about. But warm French bread with marmalade in the morning is kind of a nice start. And then we were off again.
Well, and so wintertime, most of American forces in Europe, in one way or another, were involved in what was happening in the Battle of the Bulge, whether you were there or on the perimeter of it. So where were you during that period from mid-December through the end of January, and what were you doing?
Well, we had driven up to Maastricht, Holland. I think then I was driving a 2.5-ton, and we were taking other kind of supplies. They utilized whatever they had for supplying the front lines. And we unloaded, and the big rig was staying back, and because I could go faster than a 2.5. So we're just two of us. And we were heading back down the highway, and we came to a roadblock, MPs.
Mm-hmm.
And they stopped us and said, what's wrong? They said, well, you can't go through. The Germans have broken through. And so we parked our units, and then the big unit came in, and we had to wait there with, we all had weapons. They didn't keep the 50 caliber, but I had an 1903 model Springfield, because we're not combat troops. We don't need the
fast. You don't need the M1.
Yeah, the M1s. I think the sergeant had a carbine, or I forget what the other fella had. So we had to get out, and we just stayed there. And they did have some units coming. We were on that, as the bulge went in here, we were about on this side, on the Holland side, as opposed to Belgium. And we waited that out, and we never got into any fighting there, but we had to be ready.
You're ready to take them on.
And
with your Springfield
it was plenty
rifle.
Cold. Now, that's, I got a bit of frostbite in my feet that I still suffer with, but it wasn't debilitating. It just, I thought it was okay, but as I've gotten older, my feet have caused me some problems from that. But
what kind of challenges do you deal with there? Is it just neuropathy, or feel stuff? Or
no. Well, they get the tingling where I can't sleep.
Because the nerves are fire.
They just got to move. You can't.
Yeah.
I'm doing it right now, just thinking about it, moving my toes.
Well, and I only ask because you're not alone. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of American servicemen over there who suffered frostbite, some worse than others, some to a debilitating point.
Oh, yeah.
My grandfather, who was in the medical corps there during that time, said he treated more frozen feet than anything else. Yeah, and there wasn't a whole lot you guys could do about it.
Now, see, when we were there, we weren't dressed like the people who were supposed to be there. We weren't supposed to be.
You were supposed to get in and get out.
We were supposed to be riding along in a truck.
Yeah.
And we had heavy Mackinaws, we had long underwear, tops and pants, and had combat boots, but we didn't have those big galoshes, heavy for slops, you know, sloshing along in the snow. So it was a little uncomfortable, but not as uncomfortable a lot of guys had in the Bulge.
Sure. That sounds kind of nerve-wracking, though, because you guys probably didn't know how long you were going to be stuck there.
No. Nobody knew anything. Mm-hmm. Because there's no communication.
Sure.
And we didn't know whether the Germans were going to break through in there. Then finally it came, but that wasn't probably till, it was after Christmas, but before New Year's, before they had pushed them back and they'd reopened the roads so that all the units could pass on through.
Was that kind of a nerve-wracking time for you?
Well, it's any time you don't know what's happening and you know bad things could happen. Yes, it keeps your mind. It takes a while. I did have a little Bible reading book with me, and I've read that a lot.
Hmm.
Personally given to me by Franklin Roosevelt. Well, he didn't personally give it to me, but he signed it.
He signed it.
Well, he signed the the page that was printed.
I'm just trying to imagine being in that situation, especially when you talk about what you're armed with. I mean, basically, if you've got a Springfield rifle, that's basically, hey, here's a weapon we don't think you're ever going to need, but just in case, at least you look like you're doing something.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, yeah, yes.
Was there a point where you thought I might have to use this? And, you know, we could be
kind
of...
Well, we were prepared. If it came to that, we had to. You never know what's going to happen.
What do you think would have happened if there were some German tanks in the area?
I'm sure if somebody in a Tiger tank saw that unit, they'd want to knock it out.
Yeah.
Certainly. And ground troops, without being in a defensive mode, probably wouldn't worry them that much. But a lot of Americans were taken prisoner.
Sure.
There were a lot of American prisoners because they just were overwhelmed and had no chance to fight back.
Especially during that time period.
Yeah, during the Bulge. So the dangers were there, and just grace of God, I made through.
He did, and he's still going strong at 92. I'm going to let you hear him sing a little when we come back. Check out the photos of today's guest, Larry Cosgrove, at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Trailer for sale or rent, room to let 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets. Ain't got no cigarettes, about 2 hours of push and broom. Buzz a 8x12 4-bit room. I'm a man of means by no means. King of the road.
That is our guest today, 92-year-old Larry Cosgrove, singing like he does every Wednesday and Friday night at Curly's in Signal Hill, California. King of the Road could have been his theme song while transporting tanks and other supplies with the 467th Ordnance Evacuation Company. You just heard some of his musical ability, but during World War II, he thought he'd have the chance to see one of the most famous musicians of the era, Glenn Miller, who rose to the rank of major in the Army Air Corps and performed hundreds of times for the troops in Europe. I know this story is kind of bittersweet, Larry, but tell me the story about Glenn Miller after the liberation of Paris.
Oh, yes, that was when we first got into Paris, and we had come up with a, that time it was a convoy, and we went to Vincennes. They were billeting soldiers at the Paris racetrack, and so they had all these horse stalls, and they just thrown some straw in there, and we had our own sleeping bags, so we were sleeping there. And somebody said, hey, Glenn Miller's supposed to be in doing a show in downtown Paris. So we put on, got out of our drugging clothes and put on our Class A uniform, no tie, but everything else. We hopped the metro from Vincennes into downtown Paris. We got off the train and we walked it, asked somebody where the theater was, and they pointed out and at least gave us directions. And when we came to the square, there was a million GIs there, all wanting to get in the theater. And we couldn't even get close to it. And then a few days later, we found out that, I wonder what happened to that. And then somebody who'd gotten some news said, oh, Glenn Miller didn't show up. The band played, but Miller never was there. And then later on, we, you know, heard that he was, the band flew in a C-47, but he came in a small plane and never got there.
And they've never found him.
Nope. Still so don't know what happened there.
Still a mystery today.
It's like Amelia Earhart.
Yeah. Did that hit you hard? I mean, here's a guy, I'm sure you'd been listening to his music the whole time.
I think it, yeah, we think it's a real loss, both to the morale of the being able to do the morale type stuff, but also, hey, that was one of our favorite band leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, before the war, before we came in the war, he was one of the most popular. Yeah, I think we were all pretty sad that we lost him. At early time, we didn't know he was lost. We just heard that he didn't show up.
Right.
And then we were off doing our stuff, and it wasn't until much later, one of the Stars and Stripes, they called the little newspaper that we got, and they were always way behind before they ever got to our units because we weren't attached to, you know, one big unit. So sometimes things like that came in slow.
Well, speaking of learning of things, do you remember when you first learned of the existence of these concentration camps and what was happening there?
No, that wasn't something that ever was made known until after the war. We knew that, you know, you'd read that before I went in the Army, that Nazis were persecuting the Jews and that they were many put in concentration camps. That was known to the world, I guess, before we got in the war. But we didn't know to what extent it was, and I didn't really read about that till after the war.
Pretty hard to fathom, isn't it?
Yes, just a little sideline, nothing to do with me, but my brother's brother-in-law, his unit were the first one to rescue Dachau, and he said it just made him sick. He says he threw up and he saw how horrible it was. But that's a sideline. It wasn't part of my experience.
It's the reality, and it's also true that your being over there and doing your job was part of an effort that finally closed those down and liberated the survivors that were left.
Yes.
Does that give you some satisfaction?
Well, it's the overall satisfaction of defeating the Germans. I think we all knew it was evil. We all knew that eventually it had to be destroyed. And that was one thing I think that gave us a lot of incentive, was we did have an objective. I can see today about Vietnam and Korea and people who are there and saying, you know, what are we doing? But we knew what we were doing.
So when VE Day came, was that pretty big news?
I was on guard duty up on a hill. I remember the sergeant of the guard came out and said, well, we're not going to have to go to Germany now. The Germans have surrendered. Yeah, we were happy. Because we were in line to be in the frontline combat. And if it had gone on another month, I'm sure I would have been up there in the front lines. But it just happened.
But it wasn't over yet for you, because the war's still going on the other side of the world.
They put me with a chemical processing company, and we had them in Europe, too. They were there, but in case the Germans used gas, any kind of chemical warfare, they would be there to treat the people and the equipment and whatever got contaminated. And so they sent me to Marseille, and I was there for probably 2 weeks, and then I got assigned to that company. They were just getting ready to get on the ship. They shipped us through the Panama Canal over to the Philippines, in northern Luzon. We set up there, started getting all our equipment ready and moving it in, and we got the announcement that the atom bombs had been dropped. We didn't know what kind of bombs. They just said, hey, apparently we bombed several cities in Japan so heavily that they've now surrendered, so we're not going to have to invade Japan, which made us feel good. That was a relief.
Yeah, what do you think would have happened if those bombs didn't drop and in the invasion?
If we'd had to invade, the casualties on both sides would have been horrendous, because every issue we had where we were into their homeland, they fought to the death. At least that's what we were told. And the evidence since has proven it even there in the Philippines, because there were still Japanese after Japan had surrendered that didn't even know they'd surrendered. So they
were years.
In northern Luzon. Yeah, that went on a long time. They were still warning us, you know, don't go. We had no reason to go up there. We'd just be sightseeing. And they said, hey, that's an area you don't want to go. They brought us home according to point system. People that had more points, more battle stars. If you had a Purple Heart or a Silver Star or anything, you got points for those. Mm-hmm. Any award. I had 2 battle stars, and then how many months I'd been in the Army and how many months overseas. And so I got those points. But there were a lot of us. And they had no expectation that those bombs were going to be dropped. That was a total secret to most of the people in the Army, even at the top level.
Truman didn't even know about them until Roosevelt died.
Yeah.
So imagine that.
There was no preparation for, hey, we shipped all these guys over there. How are we going to get them home? So it took quite a while. So I was there from July or August, I guess, was when the Japanese surrendered. And it wasn't until January that they brought us home. So we just had to look busy.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, had the invasion gone forward, that there would have been astronomical casualties on both sides.
Yes.
Have you ever pondered whether you would have been one of them?
I never really thought about that. Would I have to do some combat-type service in Japan? And so it wasn't a thing that was surging in my mind as we sailed. We didn't know where we're going. And some people were saying, oh, they're taking us home. We're going to go to New York. It was all just guesswork.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until we got on the ship and the ship sailed out of Marseille. It was a big new troop transport, about 6,000 troops. After we got out of the Mediterranean, they said, now we're released to tell you where we're going.
Well, and I'm not trying to press you, and I'm not trying to point to a specific answer. I'm just interested in what you genuinely think. You've got a lot of years of reflection since then, and examination and learning. You've read about what the invasion would have looked like, that, you know, they estimated 1 million Americans and more than that on the Japanese end. So knowing all that you know now, what do you think? You think you would have survived an invasion of Japan?
Well, if they were looking for 1 million casualties, my luck would have been about a 50%, I guess, because I think there were about 2 million American soldiers in the Pacific theater. If half of them would go, it's a pretty good chance. But that's, you know, we were, I don't want to say happy-go-lucky, that wasn't the right thing, but most all of us had a very positive attitude about our chance of survival from the very start. We knew we had a purpose. We have a target, and we're going to get it. Sooner or later, we have no doubt that America is America. we'll always win.
Larry's positive outlook hasn't changed much more than seven decades later. He did realize after a drafting class that engineering wasn't exactly his thing, but accounting sounded good. He became a CPA and rose through the ranks of Rockwell International in the aerospace industry. Just recently, he added another mission to his list, a trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southland. So what was that like, Larry? What were the highlights of your Honor Flight experience?
We started out with all those different memorials, and one that I was impressed by, the changing of the guard at Arlington and watching the precision and the absolute perfection of their movements. And when the officer of the day comes out and inspects the rifles and just how he really goes over them, thorough inspection. Then I thought, but they look like high school kids.
Well, and during World War II, you looked like a high school kid.
Yeah, well, I was.
Exactly.
Not much faster.
So when you went to that National World War II Memorial and you took that in, the pillars for every state,
yeah,
and the storyboards for different battles,
yeah,
Battle of the Bulge right there, you remember. Yeah. And then the gold stars, 406,000 Americans who didn't come home like you did. What kind of things went through your mind there? What were you thinking about or reflecting on?
Well, it brought back a lot of the memories. I was pointing out to my son, there's one big map there, and, you know, here's the places I went, and probably telling him more about my Army days during those 3 days than I did the rest of his life.
You don't say that lightly. You mean that.
No, I do mean that. It just, we came home and we didn't talk about it. Just happy that things worked out. We did our job. Those tanks had to get up to the front, or Patton wouldn't have been moving like he was. And all the other stuff we hauled up was necessary, and we performed a service and did the best job we could. And we're happy, for the most part. Most of the fellows were happy that they were able to serve. So that was it. And then when we got home, it was just unbelievable as we walked in. Fife and drum corps. Some kids, some young folks, several other musical groups, and people all along that are welcoming us home and just and blowing your mind. You know, wow. And as we come out there, everywhere cheering, and then they announced our name, and then everybody's cheering. Really, really getting your heart, you know, that people care. You know, there are people that really honor us, even though, you know, they say, oh, look at the heroes. I'm not a hero. I mean, Audie Murphy was a hero. We just did what we had to do and made it. So it was quite a experience.
Did your eyes stay dry?
I was laughing all the time. Hey, how are you? Waving my Thank you.
Uh-huh.
I was very happy that people seemed to care. That's what made us feel good.
Well, let me join the chorus and say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story.
You're welcome.
Is there something that you would say you're most proud of or you're most thankful for at age 92?
I have 3 points that come to my mind that I couldn't pass. I've got a daughter, Teresa. I have a son, Joseph, and I have a stepson, Paul. I'm blessed. My life, although I spend a lot of time at Toastmasters, I sing with a jazz band, I bowl, I do a lot of things, they're still the pillars of my life. Make it worthwhile.
How worthwhile it is. Larry Cosgrove, 92 years old. Catch him singing at Curly's on the corner of Cherry and Willow in Signal Hill, California, every Wednesday and Friday. Also, pull up the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com to hear the rest of Larry singing King of the Road, more of his stories from the war, and even some thoughts about Larry from his stepson, Paul Laufer, who recommended him for Hometown Heroes. That's the end of our radio time for today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
Trailer for sale or rent, room to let 50 cents, no phone, no pool, no pets. Ain't got no cigarettes, about 2 hours of push and broom. Buzz a 8x12 4-bit room. I'm a man of means by no means, king of the road. Third boxcar midnight train, destination Bangor, Maine. Old worn out suit and shoes, I don't pay no union dues. I smoke old stogies I have found, short but not the big around. I'm a man of means by no means, King of the Road.
All right. As promised, Larry Cosgrove on King of the Road. If you catch him at Curly's in Signal Hill, you'll get more of a jazz flavor. I also told you we'd hear from Larry's stepson, Paul Laufer. Paul's biological father served in the Marine Corps in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, and later died from complications from his time in Vietnam. When Larry Cosgrove became Paul's stepfather, Paul says it changed his life, and he even credits his successful IT career in database management to Larry's influence.
Larry Cosgrove is probably the greatest treasure in my life today. I've known him since 1974, and he is a wealth of good news for people who want to learn ways to be happy in their lives. Just a wealth of things I'll never forget you telling me that if you want to know what you're going to do in your career, make a list. And I did. I wrote down a list of things that I wanted to do. And he said, it doesn't matter if you're physically incapable or if you're too tall to be an astronaut. Doesn't matter. Put it down, because it's not necessarily a list of all the things you're going to do. It's a list of who you want to be. And you're going to look over that list and come up with something that you're happy to do every day. And I heard you say during your interview that you never bothered, you didn't worry about getting up Monday morning and going to work because you enjoyed doing it. So find something that you enjoy doing and something that you're happy doing and that you're proud of. And he gave me my first computer in about 1990 and more or less created the monster. Had you not done that, I have no idea what I'd be doing today, but I owe so much of my life and my success to Larry that I could never repay him, but I try a little bit here and there. We get together about every 2 or 3 months.
When you hear him talk about what he did during World War II, is there something that really grabs hold of you that makes you think, what would I do in that situation, or just gives you more respect or admiration for him?
To tell you the truth, I feel a small twinge of jealousy because I know that he and people like him knew what they were doing and had no doubt about the focus of their objective. And me being a child of the 60s, we were far more wishy-washy. And I'm reminded of Larry reacting once when I said that he was a member of the greatest generation. And he said, don't call me that. And I was kind of shocked because you would think that you would want to have a label like that. I'm in the greatest generation. But he said his parents were the greatest generation, that they went through struggles just as great, and that he believed that you should measure a generation on the generation that they produce. And his parents produced his generation, whereas he produced Woodstock, which I thought was pretty clever. And when you put it that way, most people kind of shake their head and say, oh, yeah, you got a point there. I love him deeply, and I'm very thankful. And Paul, I appreciate you coming here. I've heard you on the radio several times, and I truly appreciate what you do. I grew up in a military family, and I was born on base, and most of my siblings were born on base, and we grew up respecting that. And it's important to have people like you that carry it on. So thank you.